On the title page of Sartor Resartus, Thomas Carlyle, in the guise of Diogenes Teufelsdroch, quotes from Goethe, "My inheritance, how lordly, wide and fair, time is my estate, to time I am heir." Time for Carlyle is the arena of individual human experience, and thus he evokes the great man in On Heroes and Hero Worship. There is but one temple in the universe, the body of man, the miracle of miracles, the great inscrutable mystery of God. I liken common languid times, with their unbelief, distress, perplexity, with their languid doubting characters and embarrassed circumstances, impotently crumbling down into ever distress, towards final ruin. All this I liken to dead fuel, waiting for the lightning out of heaven that shall kindle it. The great man, with his free force direct out of God's own hand, is lightning. In his 1830 essay on history, Carlyle declares, "If history is philosophy, teaching by experience, the writer fitted to compose history is hitherto an unknown man. The experience would require all knowledge to record it. Historians should lower such pretensions, more suitable for omniscience than for human science, and aiming only at some picture of things acted, which picture itself will at best be a poor approximation. Pause over the mysterious vestiges of him whose path is in the great deep of time, whom, indeed, history reveals, but only all history, and in eternity will clearly reveal. Let us search more and more into the past. Let all men explore it as the true fountain of knowledge, by whose light alone, consciously or unconsciously employed, can the present and the future be interpreted or guessed at. History is not only the fittest study, but the only study, and includes all others whatsoever." History for Carlyle went beyond academic study and assumed an air of genuine religiosity. History, the study of past times, the study of human action, lay at the centre of Thomas Carlyle's work, because his version of history was on par with scripture, reconciling mere facts to the transcendent truths of poetry. The fictitious inventions of poetry were insufficient for Carlyle's purpose. Empirical history was required as its foundation, indeed its elevation. History offered an alternative means of pursuing the divine. As such, his work is often met with consternation by modern historians. Carlyle's emphasis on the heroic, the irrational, and the poetic, in summary, the inspirational, betrays his lack of sympathy towards the historiographical trends firmly established by the time of his writing of Frederick the Great, that of the scientific and objective professional historian, following the spirit of von Ranke's famous axiom, wie es eigentlich gewesen, how things really are. While I am unable to reconcile Carlyle completely to scientific history, I will illustrate the fundamental value of Carlyle to my subject. Moreover, that he is not a historiographical freak, as he has sometimes been referred. Rather, he could be situated clearly in the rich philosophy of German Romanticism, to which academic history as we know it owes a great debt. R.G. Collingwood states in his Idea of History, "How or on what conditions can the historian know the past?" The first point to note is that the past is never a given fact which can be apprehended empirically by perception. Ex hypothesi, the historian is not an eyewitness of the facts he desires to know, nor does the historian fancy that he is. He knows quite well that his only possible knowledge of the past is intermediate, inferential, or indirect, never empirical. The second point is that this mediation cannot be affected by testimony. The historian does not know the past by simply believing a witness who saw the events in question and has left the evidence on record. That kind of mediation would give at most not knowledge but belief. The historian, once more, knows very well that this is not the way in which he proceeds. He is aware that what he does to his so-called authorities is not to believe them, but to criticize them. If then the historian has no direct or empirical knowledge of his facts and transmittal testimonial knowledge of them, what kind of knowledge has he? In other words, what must the historian do in order that he may know them? My answer is that the historian must reenact the past in his own mind. History is not a spectacle. The events of history do not pass in review before the historian. He has to recreate them inside his own mind. Reenacting for himself so much of the experience of the man who took part in them as he wishes to understand. Moving on from this definition of Collingwood's, contrast this with the notion of antiquarian. The past leaves relics, even when these relics are left unused as materials for his history. These relics are of many kinds and include relics of historical thought itself, namely chronicles. We preserve these relics in the hope that in the future they may become what they are not already, historical evidence. Insofar as we recognize that these too will one day interest us, we make it our business not to lose or destroy those records. This is the task of the antiquarian. The antiquarian keeps pots in his museum as the archivist keeps public documents. So the scholar edits, amends, and reprints texts of ancient philosophy without necessarily understanding the philosophical ideas they express, and therefore unable to reconstruct the history of philosophy. Too often this work is mistaken for that of the true historian, and Carlyle is both cognizant and scathing of that fact. Friedrich Schiller, the great German poet and historian, emphasized that the study of a universal history required a philosophical mind as well as historical scholarship. To this end, Schiller paints the picture of the Blutgeleiter, the professional historical researcher whose ambition is to become a narrower specialist as possible and go on knowing more and more about less and less. Dr. Dryasdust, an invention by Sir Walter Scott and the quintessential Blutgeleiter, was a device employed by Carlyle, himself a devotee of Schiller. In his introduction to Letters and Speeches of Oliver Cromwell, Carlyle casts himself as the anti-Dryasdust historian. Those dreary old records, they were compiled at first by human insight in part, and in great part by human stupidity. They lie there, printed, written, to the extent of tons and square miles, as shot rubbish, unedited, unsorted, not so much as indexed, fully of every conceivable confusion, yielding light to very few, yielding darkness and several sorts to very many. Dull pedantry, conceited idle dilettantism, prurient stupidity in what shape soever, is darkness and not light. There are from 30 to 50,000 unread pamphlets of the Civil War in the British Museum alone. Huge piles of mouldering wreck, wherein, at the rate of perhaps one pennyweight per ton, lie things memorable. They lie there, preserved, waiting happier days, until present condition they cannot, except for idle purposes, for dilettante excerpts, and such like be got examined. To Dryasdust, who wishes merely to compile torpedo histories of the other sorts of the philosophical, and gain immortal laurels of himself by writing about it, and about it all this is sport, but lo, us who struggle piously, passionately to behold it, but in glimpses, the faces of our vanished fathers, it is death. O Dryasdust, my voluminous friend, had human stupidity continued in the diligent state, think you it had ever come to this? Surely at least you might have made an index for those huge books. Even your genius, had you been faithful, was adequate to that. Those 30,000 to 50,000 old newspapers and pamphlets in the King's Library. It is you, my voluminous friend, that should have sifted through them many long years ago, instead of droning out these melancholy scepticisms, constitutional philosophies, torpedo narratives, you should have sifted those old stacks. There is no silence like the speech you cannot listen to without danger of locked jaw. Given a divine heroism, to smother it well in human dullness, to touch it with the mace of death, so that no human soul shall henceforth recognize it for heroism. But all souls shall fly from it as a chaotic torpor and insanity and horror. I will back our English genius against the world in such a problem. Rather than offer a straw man to Carlyle's position, I draw your attention to the emerging positivist school of historiography that rose to prominence in the 1830s and 40s. At the time when Carlyle was working on his magnum opus, The French Revolution, positivism may be defined as a philosophy acting in the service of natural science. But the positivists had their own rather special notion of what natural science was, consisting of two things. First, the ascertaining of facts. Second, the framing of laws. The facts were immediately ascertained by sensory perception. The laws were framed through generalizing from these facts by induction. The result was a vast increase of detailed historical knowledge, based to an unprecedented degree on accurate and critical examination of evidence, the age which enriched history by the compilation of vast masses of carefully sifted material like patent rolls, the corpus of Latin inscriptions, new editions of historical texts, and sources of every kind, and the whole apparatus of archaeological research. The best historians, like Mommsen or Maitland, became the great masters of detail. The historical conscience identified itself, and infinite scrupulosity about any and every isolated matter of fact. The ideal of historical literature became the monograph. The two complaints against positivism imply that the mere ascertaining all facts for their own sake was unsatisfactory, and that its justification lay beyond itself in something further that could or should be done with the facts thus ascertained. Into this situation, Auguste Comte demanded that historical facts should be used as the raw material of something more important and more genuinely interesting than themselves. Every natural science, said the positivists, began by ascertaining facts and then went on to discover their causal connections. Comte proposed that there should be called a new science called sociology, which was to begin by discovering the facts about human life and then go on to discover the causal connection between these facts. A sociologist would thus be a kind of super historian, raising history to the rank of science by thinking scientifically about the same facts about which the historian had only thought empirically. However, the historians of the 19th century had worked on a new method of handling sources, the method of philological criticism. This consisted of two operations. First, the analysis of the sources into their component parts, distinguishing earlier and later elements in them, and thus enabling the historian to discriminate between the more or less trustworthy positions. Secondly, the internal criticism of those even trustworthy parts, showing how the author's point of view affected his statement of the facts, the answer enabling the historians to make allowance for the distortions thus produced. The invitation by the positivists to then hurry on beyond to the ascertaining of facts, to the discovery of general laws, was generally abandoned. The claim of Comtean sociology was set aside by abler and more conscientious historians who came to regard it as sufficient for them to discover and state the facts themselves in the manner of Leopold von Ranke. Historical knowledge still conceived its facts in a positivistic manner as separate or atomic. This led historians to adopt two rules of methods in their treatment of facts. First, each fact was to be regarded as a thing capable of being ascertained by a separate act of cognition or process of research, and thus the total field of the historically knowable was cut up into an infinity of minute facts, each to be separately considered. Secondly, each fact was to be thought of not only as independent of all the rest, but as independent of the knower, so that all subjective elements in the historian's point of view had to be eliminated. The historian must pass no judgment on the facts. The first trained historians to attend accurately to matters of detail. The second trained them to avoid colouring their subject matter with their own emotional reactions. The first led to the corollary that nothing was a legitimate problem for history unless it was either a microscopic problem or else capable of being treated as a group of microscopic problems. Thus, Mommsen was able to compile a corpus of inscriptions or a handbook of Roman constitutional law with almost incredible accuracy. His attempt to write a history of Rome broke down exactly at the point where his own contributions to Roman history began to become important. He devoted his life to the study of the Roman Empire, and his history of Rome ends the Battle of Actium before its inception. The legacy of positivism to modern historiography on the side of its work, therefore, is a combination of unprecedented mastery over small-scale problems with unprecedented weakness in dealing with large-scale problems. Returning to Schiller and the German influences on Carlyle, the former was concerned with the nature and value of universal history. For the philosophical historian who takes all history for his province, makes it his business to see the connections between the facts and detect the large-scale rhythms of the historical process. The philosophical historian achieves these results by entering sympathetically into the actions which he describes. Unlike the scientist who studies nature, he does not stand over the facts as mere objects for cognition. On the contrary, he throws himself into them and feels them imaginatively as experiences of his own. It is this historical sympathy, coupled with imagination, that typified the German Romanticist school and the output of Carlyle, which was itself the legacy of the thought of Vico and Kant. Carlyle drew further from Johann Gottfried Herder and his historicist appreciation of the uniqueness of the past as a theory of alternating states of human development. Herder saw human life as closely related to its setting in the natural world. The general character of this world, as he conceived it, is that of an organism so designed so as to develop within itself a higher organism. Herder was the first thinker to recognize in a systemic way that there were differences between different kinds of men, and that human nature is not uniform but diversified. He pointed out that what makes Chinese civilization, for example, cannot be geography and climate of China, but only the peculiar nature of the Chinese. If different kinds of men are placed in the same environment, they will exploit the resources of that environment in different ways, and thus create different kinds of civilization. The determining fact of history is the special peculiarities not of man in general, but of this or that kind of man. These special peculiarities, Herder regarded as racial peculiarities, that is, the inherited psychological characteristics of the varieties of the human species. Herder is thus the father of modern anthropology. Another significant influence on Carlyle was Johann Gottlieb Fichte, another devotee of Kant and the author of The Characteristics of the Present Age. For Fichte, every concept has a logical structure involving three phases: thesis, antithesis, synthesis, an idea often and wrongly attributed to Hegel. The concept is first embodied in a pure or abstract form that it generates its own opposite and realizes itself in the shape of an antithesis between itself and its opposite, and the antithesis is overcome by the negation of the opposite. However, Carlyle resisted any semblance of systemic laws or cycles governing the past in favor of a model that gave full scope to the power of the transcendent and viewed change with skepticism, in stark contrast to the progressivism of Kant and Fichte. Historical change was not a slow evolution, but a series of violent upheavals, apocalyptic deaths followed by rebirth, freeing perennial moral truths for renewal and reform. Early modern history, from the Reformation through to the French Revolution, was a necessary destruction of a sham order. Nevertheless, what followed the apocalypse was not the renewal of some perennial traditionalism, but liberalism, secularism, and democracy, much to Carlyle's horror. In place of the positivistic formulas of the age, Carlyle called for a sympathetic realization of historical events in all their radical individuality, an acknowledgement of the eternal truths of which these events were emblematic. In speculating that true history was the only possible epic, Carlyle imagined a form that would be based on fact, but would celebrate the acts of human heroism and justify the ways of God to man. Carlyle's historian had to be an artist, a Virgil, a Homer, or Shakespeare, to illuminate and make real the ideal as manifested. The dry-as-dust historian was useless by comparison. The diamond necklace scandal that foreshadowed the imminent fall of Louis XVI constituted an initial experiment in this kind of poetic prophecy. Its success encouraged him to complete his first and greatest work, that of the French Revolution in 1837. In past and present, Carlyle brought history to bear upon the contemporary problems of England at the height of the Industrial Revolution by contrasting an account of governance in a medieval monastery with the abdication of paternal leadership in the present day. Carlyle wrote Oliver Cromwell in Letters and Speeches, wherein he used the Lord Protector's own words to recast the Puritan fanatic of past historical judgment as a hero, whose dedication was to restore the rule of perennial moral law in England. The pessimism induced by England's liberal direction in the 19th century sent Carlyle back to the 18th century in search of the heroic king, Frederick II of Prussia. Carlyle's core belief that the historian's responsibility was to uncover the transcendent significance of the past was betrayed by his restricted capabilities in historical research. He had limited patience with archival research and seldom applied necessary historical criticism to his sources, and as a result was more than once taken in by fabrications and hoaxes. He had little interest in proffering a comprehensive analysis of major historical events. That wasn't his goal. Instead, Carlyle produced fantastical metaphorical renderings of those elements that most aptly illuminated the sacred plots of the past. Conventional history, which in the 19th century meant political and constitutional history, was but contextual residue for Carlyle. Carlyle called history the essence of innumerable biographies, acknowledged the importance of social history in the narrative formation of national history, while his major works focused on heroes engaged in characteristically epic struggles. The events of history do not pass in review before the historian. He has to recreate them in his own mind, reenacting for himself so much of the experience of the man who took part in them as he wishes to understand. As a historical reenactor, Carlyle reached a level of genius, animating history, resurrecting it, permitting his reader to relive the events of his historical subjects vicariously, and yet he was also partially disqualified from such a pursuit. The editorial license Carlyle afforded himself in Oliver Cromwell's Letters and Speeches strained the limits of objectivity. The strategy of past and present is typical of all his histories. The past was valued not strictly for its own sake, but for the extent to which it could yield to the models for desired change in the present. I draw your attention back to the example of Dryasdust. The history misconceived consists in accepting and preserving testimony, and the writing of history consists in transcribing, translating, and compiling. Such work is useful, but it is not history. There is no criticism, no interpretation, no historical recreation, imagination, or narrative. However, when seriously evaluating Carlyle, we must draw attention to the other extreme. A one-sided insistence on feeling or passion produces a second type of pseudo-history, romantic history, whose true purpose is not to discover the truth about the past, but to express the author's feelings towards it, whether they be national, factional, liberal, or socialist. In general, all history whose function is to express either the historian's love and admiration for his subject, hagiography, or else his contempt for it. Benedetto Croce emphasized that whenever historians indulge in conjecture or permit themselves to assert mere possibilities, they are in fact giving way to the temptation of romanticizing history. They are going beyond what the evidence proves and expressing their own personal feelings by permitting themselves to believe what they would like to believe. Scientific history has no room for the merely probable, all the merely possible. All it permits the historian to assert is what the evidence before him obliges him to assert. Carlyle is too competent a writer and narrative weaver, his historical thought too nuanced and original, to dismiss his work, say of Cromwell, as mere hagiography. Yet it misses an essential component which the positivist historians, the Mommsens, Maitlands, and the other accused Dryasdusts, possessed in abundance: fidelity to the sources. Carlyle's great strength as a historian lay in the creativity and sublimity of his style, coalescing poetry with history. Historical imagination was more important to Carlyle than strict adherence to historical fact, favouring techniques that could potentially connect both reader and historian with history's perennial truths, which include all others whatsoever. Recognising that all historical events occur in a linear fashion, the action, the event in history, became a solid fixture. Carlyle utilized an innovative repertoire of literary techniques to reenact the often chaotic multiplicity of historical experience. To disclose the underlying order of divinity, manipulating perspectives, superimposing on the past, present, and future a sublime network that defied reduction to meager historical causation. At times, he withheld the historical significance of an event so that the reader first experienced it as a contemporary might, or was called upon to participate actively in constructing its meaning. Dispensing with the quintessential narrative presence of the authoritative historian, he introduced multiple narrative voices, some quoted from the actual historical record, many invented, to recreate the view of hypothetical eyewitnesses, participants, and commentators. Taken together, these voices underscored the collaborative process of constructing an understanding of the past. He used other fictive techniques, present tense verbs, inventive thoughts, actions, and dialogue, for instance, to breathe life into historical figures. He adopted a fragmented and highly selective narrative method in which vividly realized details serves as figurative shorthand to sum up character or embody larger historical phenomena. Strict continuity was sacrificed in favor of a series of events relaying certain thematic threads. Repeated epithets, labels, and personifications that punctuate his narratives serve to reinforce this kind of thematic continuity. In the context of the 19th century, the stigmatization of so-called literary history, it is necessary to underscore the structuring of historical narratives functions in a very similar way to that of literature. The historian chooses a subject, weaves together thematic threads, and selects information when deemed appropriate. History differs from literature in that history is fundamentally critical. Truth is not a feature, but a requirement. Information proffered is evidence, and the core of writing history rests on a question, an inquiry, leading to the attainment of knowledge. Carlyle's work came to represent the best and the shortcomings of so-called literary history. The very success of his idiosyncratic methods raised fears that he might mislead readers by sacrificing historical conscientiousness in order to will his perennial truths into existence. Yet for many of his contemporaries, his historical imagination captured an emotional truth about the human experience that transcended empirical fact. In this regard, Carlyle chimes with the sentiment afforded by his great rival, the famous Whig historian Macaulay. From Macaulay's 1828 essay on history, a perfect historian must possess an imagination sufficiently powerful to make his narrative affecting and picturesque. But this is insufficient. Referring to Collingwood's claim that history is the reenactment of past experience, historical imagination is not ornamental, but structural. Without it, the historian would have no narrative to adorn. Without the imagination, that blind but indispensable faculty, as described by Kant, we could never perceive the world around us, and is an indispensable component of history. It is this which, operating not capriciously as a fancy, but in its a priori form, does the entire work of historical construction. Thank you all for listening. Continuing with Carlyle Day, please check out The Prudentialist as he reviews The Hero's Man of Letters. The link is in the description. If you would like more videos of this type of historiographical content, I have a new series in the works, comparing Thomas Carlyle's Frederick the Great with the giant of 19th century German historiography, Leopold von Ranke. Otherwise, if you enjoyed this video, please like the video, leave a comment and subscribe, or perhaps consider becoming a channel member, or leave a donation via Subscribestar. Thank you.